Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington. It's Fed Day, and I couldn't ask for a better team to be here with me. Ed Harrison and Jack Farley, welcome.
Thanks, Ash.
Great to be here.
So anyone who is tired of sleepy, quiet days in markets, those times have passed. Ed, what are you looking at? How are you parsing what came out of the Fed today?
Yeah, very interesting stuff. I think that I'm looking at the 10-year, of course. Because that backed up, yields backed up in general. I think it went to 158.9 before it settled in at 156.2. That's the last figure I have. I'm also looking at places on the curve. I think the 5 year is very interesting. And the 530 is also an interesting spread to look at in terms of curve flattening or anything that we can learn from that.
Ed, let's talk a little bit about that. You cut out there for a second. I'm not sure what you said at the end, but you were talking about the spread between fives and tens. Give us a little bit of a sense of what's happening in the belly of the curve and that's relationship to the front end of the curve.
Yeah, so my understanding is that we saw a little bit of curve flattening, which would suggest that that people are starting to believe there could be a slowdown. And so irrespective of what's happening at the front end of the curve, that is a bit worrying when you see the curve flattening in the belly of the curve. I would also say that we saw the biggest uptick with the 5 year. So the 5 year ended today up 9 basis points, whereas the 10 year only went up 6 basis points. So right there, there's flattening right there. The 30-year actually went down marginally. So what you're seeing is the biggest bulge in the 5 year. You could say that this flattening is an indication that at the margin, there's the potential for a policy error. That is that the Fed is not getting the timing right, that their transition to a more hawkish statement is a suggestion that as they try to navigate the waters, the Scylla and Charybdis that we were talking about on Monday, yeah, that they don't get it right and that they hit the side and run aground.
Yeah, the 5 year was very much in motion. That jump from about 77 bips up to over 90 short term there, like 13 basis points before settling in at 89. Really a lot of motion there. Jack, as we bring this camera, zoom it out a little bit here. I mean, economy is booming, inflation is rising, questions about whether that's transient, questions about whether this growth can be sustained. What are you thinking about? What are you looking at in that context?
Well, Ash, the moment that stood out to me was a soundbite where Fed Chair Jerome Powell said, look, we have a dual mandate. We have to focus on the other side, which is price stability. So inflation is, for a first time in a while, at least in the purview of Jerome Powell. It may not be motivated for long. There was a bias towards limiting unemployment and prioritizing that over price stability. But you can tell that they clearly are worried. And of course, the chart or the fact of that is the dot plot, which shows the 18 members of the FOMC or what they think basically the federal funds rate should be, and they were markedly higher. And there are a lot of critiques about why that's important. But I think that the market is pricing in that the Fed is definitely thinking about raising rates. And you can see it right there on the dot plot. As to the slight flattening we saw, yes, the 10-year sold off hard, the 5-year sold up hard. The 2-year, that's where I think you saw the most fireworks, because I think that we actually hit something like 19 basis points, which was the highest that we've been at since June 2020. You know, since then, a real hallmark of this action has been that you know, rates have been extremely low at the yield, and even in the money market funds, some things go negative. So yeah, a lot to get into. But Ash, what did you make of the dot plot?
Well, you know, it's interesting thinking about what the dot plot is, what it does, and why it's significant. So the dot plot, as you mentioned, is 18 dots that represent the FOMC members' voting and non-voting alternates. So when you look at that chart, look at that dot plot, what you see is a series of dots that represent where each individual member of the FOMC believes interest rates are going to be at a given point in time. So when people say, you know, the median estimate is that we're going to have two rate hikes by 2023, what that's saying is that the number at which there are an equal number of dots above and below is at that point, suggesting that we're going to be at 50 basis points up from the 0 to 25 basis point federal funds target that we have today. But this is something that is very much an abstract entity that represents what individuals think about particular policies. Now, again, important to note, 18 members, only 12 voting members. So it's done so that you can see a weighting of the constituents along various points because they're rotating in and out. Even Jay Powell in the questions actually talked about this and said, like, you know, look, these dots don't represent a plan. They don't represent a consensus. This represents individual opinions about where we may be at a particular point in time. And of course, as we know, they want to stay data dependent. So if there are changes in the data, there are changes in the functioning of the economy, these are things that can be adjusted. But I'd really like to throw back to Ed and have him jump in and give his insight on what he thinks about the dot plot and the significance or potentially the lack of significance there.
Yeah, the interesting comments, Ash, because you and I both know, we were talking before we went on camera, that these dots, they're not predictive at all. That they, in the past, they've been shown to not be predictive. And as a result, you have to question what they really mean. What I would say is that what they mean in terms of the market is they're giving the market forward guidance. They're telling the market what we, the Federal Reserve, believe is the appropriate monetary stance going forward, and then you can back into, you know, the timetable based upon that. So it's the Fed's best way, the most discernible way that the Fed has to be able to tell other people, this is what's going to happen, and this is the timetable that we see it happening.
Yeah. Jack, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think perhaps, Ed, it doesn't matter. The dot plot is not as significant as some in the media are pounding their chests about. But I do think it matters in a very fundamental way because, you know, a phrase that I'm sure both of you will be familiar with is that the bond market is the truth. You know, Raoul says that a lot. And it's namely saying that equity investors don't really know the path of the economy. There's a lot of speculation. But the bond market is really pricing in the future growth of the economy. And generally, it gets things right. Well, what do bond markets trade off of? Growth expectations, of course, inflation expectations, but also Fed funds futures, which is, you know, derivatives for what is the future Fed fund rate going to be. And what do those trade off of? Largely the dot plot. So I think that the dot plot does matter to some degree. And I mean, look, in March of this year, the last FOMC meeting, you had 11 out of the 18 members say that in 2023, the Fed funds rate would be stuck between 0 and 0.25. Now there are only 5. And there are 2 people who think that the Fed funds rate could be as high as 1.5 or 1.75. So I think that, you know, you could see the bond market repricing this and you know, the daisy chain would unwind a little bit. So it's not great for bonds.
Do you know what one of the understated reasons why the dot plot is so important is? Because you can show it on television. You can show a chart that implies a sense of meaning and coherence over something that is incredibly unpredictable, that statistical analysis shows when you do the regression analysis, the correlations are very weak, but you can show it on television and you can scratch your chin and you can say meaningful sounding things about it.
Yeah, I agreed. And you know, the bottom line here is that there's no interest rate lever for the Fed. And so they have the forward guidance lever. They're using the forward guidance lever. The dot plot is the anchor of the forward guidance lever. They're telling you with the dot plot, this is what we think is appropriate at these specific times in the future. And we can use that in order to understand how the Fed is going to react to data based upon that. So right. That's all they can do when they're at the zero lower bound. If we were at 5% interest rates, they could raise or lower interest rates, but they can't do that now because they've run out of bullets. So this is the Fed essentially telling you, we've run out of bullets, but you know there are some other things that we can do. I was talking to David Rosenberg and to Peter Bukar about this. This is an interview that's going to come up. I call it the rumble in the jungle. It's the inflationista against the deflationista. And we were talking about the fact that the Fed's run out of bullets. What else are you supposed to do?
I'm sure there are more 13-3 programs that we can be that can be rolled out, Ed. Listen, well, you know,
it is interesting that you would say that because right before we came on, we were looking at the 12 voting members of the Fed, the FOMC, and the 6 non-voting members of the FOMC. And yeah. One of the non-voting members of the FOMC, if you look him up, Eric Rosengren, the thing that you see that he's noted for in the very recent past before they had their silent period is as making it seem as if when they start to taper, that they're going to taper housing-backed bond purchases first. So Eric Rosengren, he was speaking and saying that maybe it's not going to be 80-40, maybe it's going to be 80-20 instead. So if you go from 120 bond purchases, 120 billion to 100 billion, it will be all in the mortgage-backed security arena. So when we think of the timetable being moved forward, and I would say that therefore you have to think what's going to be moved forward. Is it going to be the time between now and the taper? Is it going to be the period of the taper, or is it going to be the time between when you finish tapering and you start raising rates? So those right. are the three periods that we have to think about. Likely, it's going to be the time period, at least in part, between now and when the taper begins. And when that taper begins, potentially, it's going to be in the MBS market. So to the degree that we're thinking about the dot plot, we should be thinking about the dot plot and what Eric Rosengren is saying with regard to MBS.
Yeah, so it's the constituency of that of the balance sheet and the timing of what the taper looks like. 80 billion in treasury bonds per month, 40 billion in agency debt, the mortgage-backed security debt per month, and what that tapering and what the constituency looks like. Ed, one of the things that struck me as very interesting is sort of media theater dot plot stuff to the side. Jay Powell opened up his remarks by talking about adding powerful support. He talked about bond buying and continued low rates. He talked about this in the context of, you know, effectively having an accommodative monetary policy, which we still have. This is important for people to understand. The monetary policy is still incredibly accommodative at this moment relative to the neutral policy rate. It is still acting as a gas pedal and not a brake. And then he made the case, I thought, in a very subtle way for this argument about the temporary aspect of inflation. He talked about near-term supply constraints, supply bottlenecks, hiring difficulties. This is something that would be supportive of the general thesis that there is a temporary frictional inflation in the market right now because in the broader economy, because of the rehiring. But then he hedged that bet to a certain extent when he talked about that the fact that inflation could be higher and more persistent than we expect, that's a direct quote, and said, if inflation is higher, we're prepared to adjust our stance on monetary policy, meaning to either slow the withdrawal of accommodation or, presumably, based on that language, perhaps increase again.
Right, yeah. So essentially, inflation is not dead as part of their mandate, he's saying, and we're looking at it. But no one knows where inflation is going to be. They just have a stance, but he's warning us that if their stance is wrong, potentially they could be behind the curve. So I think that that's the hidden message in that. Maybe Jack has some thoughts there.
Well, when you say behind the curve, do you mean yield curve control?
No, I mean that if inflation it picks up and faster than they think, and it's less transitory than they think, then they're forced to remove accommodation more quickly than they had anticipated, which would mean that they're behind the curve. Their present stance today, it was wrong. And now they have to adjust that stance, and potentially they have to mash on the brakes more aggressively than they had thought. And that's where the potential for a policy error comes into play, which is why I've mentioned that the 5-year was the thing that rolled off the most. It went up the most yield, and you saw flattening from 5 to 30. That was pretty significant. It was about 11 basis points.
Yeah. And this is the challenge, Ed, is that you're, in a certain extent, as I said yesterday with Tony Greer, driving by looking in the rearview mirror. We won't know whether this is a temporary bout of inflation that's caused by frictional supply and demand mismatch factors and near-term constraints until we see further data. And at that point, we will have either been mashing on the gas too hard by being too accommodative, or we'll need to withdraw that. So it is, as you've said so many times before, the Scylla and Charybdis. One final point that I wanted to throw your way, Ed, because I really want your opinion on this. So where the rubber meets the road here, where we are in the economy, where we are in financial markets, it's really about the dual mandate, both sides of it. It's prices, it's inflation, and it's jobs. The other thing that Jay Powell mentioned that I thought was so important that I'd really like to hear your take on is LFPR. This is the labor force participation rate. It is the Civ Part series at the St. Louis Fed Fred database where you can see it. It peaks, by the way, the first important thing to say is this is rolled over since the year 2000. The 2000 era peak was at about 67% labor force participation. Prior to the COVID crisis, we were at 63%, so 3 points lower, 3 to 4 points lower on that. We went from 63% on LFPR, at worst down to 60%. It's recovered roughly 1/3 to 1/2. That means there are people who have withdrawn from the labor force very, very rapidly. This is not what a demographic retrenchment in the labor force looks like. Far too rapid. The slope of that curve, far too steep to the downside. What do you make of the labor situation in regard to that rate?
Hidden employment. So what Powell was saying is that clearly there are some people who've just retired early. And as a result, you know, demographic forces are at play. Let's say they were retired 2 years early or 3 years early, over 2 or 3 years, that anomaly will go away, that early retirement. That's partially related to the pandemic. But beyond that, there is still slack in the labor force because that rate has gone down so precipitously but not come up enough. To me, it suggests, as it did to Jay Powell, that there is still slack. And what they've seen right before, when they talk about what is a full employment level, that we were able to get further and further down in terms of unemployment, and suddenly, you know, people started reentering the workforce late in the cycle. That's what happened at the end of the last cycle, and Jay Powell mentioned that today in the presser. And so what he's saying is that we believe the same thing will happen again, and that makes a lot of sense. So I think that labor force participation rate, that it's low, and it will go up given time.
Ed, one final point on the labor market, the jobs market. The youth rate, the official total unemployment rate, is at 5.8%, which is still no great shakes. This is still consistently elevated above the baseline. The U6 rate, this is the total number of unemployed, including those who are marginally attached to the labor force, is at over 10% at 10.2%. So you have far lower than normal than would be expected from ordinary demographic roll-off in the LFPR. And then you have the official U3 rate as well as the unofficial U6 rate looking significantly elevated. That's not a pretty picture. Now, look, we've recovered consistently here up from a peak at 13% in May of 2020, looking at the data that I see in front of me right now on the U3 rate. So considerable improvement. But boy, by historical standards, these are still not fully employed labor markets.
Yeah, we're not anywhere close to full employment in my view. The interesting bit about just putting it all together, what happened today, is that when you look at the so-called interest rate toggle from an equities perspective, you have the Dow down 0.75%, you have the S&P down 0.5%, and then you have the NASDAQ down 0.25%. So it's we're back to the whole nexus where interest rates going up hurt reopening, cyclical stocks, industrials more, you know, the Dow type stocks, and they hurt the NASDAQ less. I found that interesting because when we were talking about the interest rate toggle, it was really that when interest rates went up, actually that should be negative for tech.
Right.
What I think was happening there is actually the flattening of the yield curve that we're seeing in play. So when the 530s flatten by 11 basis points, basically what it's telling you is that there's the potential for the hitting running aground in the whole Scylla Charybdis thing, and you want to get the growthiest stocks that you can in that scenario. And so therefore, tech wins. We're back to the old paradigm where growth over value wins. That's my interpretation of how the market shaked out today in terms of the bond market, thinking about employment, and also thinking about the equity market.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level. The who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Such an important point. When we look at the sector rotation through the lens of select sector spiders, for example, we can see XLK, that's the technology select sector spider, off about 0.5% today. Consumer staples, a bigger loser, minus 1.33%. That's XLP.
Yeah. So we're seeing some incipient rotation back into growth stocks. To me, that speaks to downside risk from a second half underperformance for the economy and the potential that the Fed could accelerate that by tightening into a deceleration of the economy.
Jack, jump in. I know you have something to say.
Yeah, well, I think it makes sense. If 30-year rates stay roughly range-bound on a day where the 10-year surges almost 10 basis points, it would make sense that the high duration stocks, the stocks like Tesla, where you know most of its profits are going to be well in the future, are going to stay put roughly. And you know that would be, I actually think that's consumer discretionary, which was the only sector that was up 16 basis points. The ones that took it on the chin today were utilities, as you say, and consumer staples. You know, a water plant or an energy plant or like you know selling toilet paper, that's not exactly a growth business. So not surprising that they were down the most today. Interestingly, I did know is that ARKK, which you know the ARK, which consists of the super growth stocks, that did not fare super well. So it could be a point, sort of an ennui that you know this is not a great time to own bonds. And if the yield curve everywhere goes up, that's not great for the super high duration stocks.
Right. Good point.
But if you guys have something on the equities, by all means, go. But I want to. But did you make of any sense of the commodity action? Because Ash, in your interview yesterday with Tony Greer, he said that the metal traders will have to have their fingers on the pulse. They'll have to be ready. If there's some tightening, and that's exactly what we saw. And I look at copper and nickel fell 4% apace, and those are commodities which have been red hot, but have recently encountered some steam recently. Gold down 2% at $18.21 per ounce. Oil was a little bit more resilient, barely moved 40 basis points. But yeah, what do you guys think of the price action, either in commodities or if you want to go back to equities?
I honestly think that it definitely supports the thesis that there's increasing risk that we move from what Darius Dale calls the reflation quadrant to the deflation quadrant. And that what it's saying is that all this inflation that people were talking to is actually transitory. It's all rolling over. Commodities, it was mostly in commodities anyway, lumber, lead. Now we're seeing it in copper rolling over. We're seeing it in other commodities. Gold and silver aren't reacting. And, technology is now bid. All of that together suggests that at the margin, downside risk for the economy in the second half is increased. And if you want to give it a political lens, the reason it's increased is because the Democrats, even though they want to pour it on for the midterms, they have to do reconciliation. Joe Manchin has basically said that I'm not going to let you guys pour it on. We have to do something that is more centrist and that limits the amount of stimulus that the Democrats can put into play. And peak stimulus is in the rearview mirror now. So once we get to the fall, we roll off a lot of the pandemic unemployment assistance. We're not going to have a massive infrastructure bill. There is downside risk in terms of the economy rolling over. So I think at the margin, the markets understand that.
Right, and that could be bad for bonds for two reasons. One, because there's not enough money in the economy or as much money because there's less stimulus. And obviously then, if there's not a lot of growth, you want to own a greater percentage of bonds. But also to fund the stimulus, fewer bonds will be issued. So there won't be a supply glut that we've been seeing. Sorry, Ash, I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to add to that, to Ed's point on the politics, that Joe Manchin really is the kingmaker at this point in the Senate, and it really is going to be interesting to see what a very divided Democratic Party between that position and some of the folks who are further to the left think, and how that's going to get resolved, because it really is, to me at least, very much an open issue, ideologically a very different perspective. And I was just going to add, big loser of the day on my commodities board here is LME Copper. Looks like it's off 4%, to give a bit of context for that, gold off, I think, 1.5, COMEX gold.
Mm. Yep. Yeah.
That's also risk off if you want to, it's never good to interpret macro regimes from one day's trading. But I mean, copper's down more than gold.
But it is pricing based on macro events today, right? I mean, this isn't like a copper mine somewhere in Bolivia. This is literally coming off of what came out of the Fed. So obviously, definitely right. It's always difficult to price on a single day or to draw broad conclusions, but it certainly looks like this trading is about macro action.
Yeah, definitely. You can see like a huge fall off right around when the FOMC came out. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I want to ask a question. Ed, do you think that the party is over in terms, for the past over a year, it's just been buy stocks, sell puts, short bonds. It's just been risk on, risk on, risk on. It's been a great party. Do you think the party's over? Or is it slowing?
I think we're in the interregnum. I think last year when we had the reopening rally, I said that September, October was sort of a pivot point. And we could go higher from there if we passed the test. We did pass the test and we went higher. In fact, we passed the test with flying colors in November, especially with the vaccine, and we went much higher. I think we're at a similar point now with the reopening, with the full reopening, where we're coming up on a period where we're going to know much more exactly whether or not inflation is transitory, whether or not we've reached peak stimulus, and whether or not all of that pent-up demand that people are talking about is actually going to continue to be a factor. All of those three things will be coming to a head at the end of Q2 and the beginning of Q3.
Yeah. We are about halfway in here at this point, and no surprise, the questions are absolutely lighting up. Let's hit some of these questions and talk a little bit about what's happening. The first one comes to us from, I hope I'm saying this right, Diamet Das. The question is for Ed. Why did the market reverse direction today?
Yeah. it's one of those things that I know that Ash, he's big on this. We have no idea, right? I mean, it's all confabulation. If you know why the market moved up or down, unless it's completely obvious because of a statement by the FOMC or, you know, something that was remarkable, it's anyone's guess. So I have no idea.
Did he mean, though, that reverse, as in why did it crash, or, you know, flash crash, let's say, or why did it go back up?
Why did it go back up? If you look at the chart, like of the S&P, you see that at about 1400 hours around 2 o'clock when the statement comes out, it hits a trough looks like around 445 and then reverses. I mean, as Ed said, it's all confabulation. I'll throw one out. My own theory was that some of this just has to do with the personality of the Fed chair. There's something about Jay Powell that seems very reassuring and stable. Now, I'm not talking about policy here. I'm just talking about the personality of the guy who is delivering the speech today. He did a very strong job with answering questions. He has an air of kind of humility about him. He seems very empathetic. He doesn't sound like a Harvard University professor who's lecturing from up high. He sounds like he's open to data. Now, again, this is all kind of almost a very soft aspect of it. Maybe you could call it theatrics even. But it was a very strong performance in terms of, I thought, his delivery of the speech and his engagement with the reporters.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So let's move on here to some more questions. This is a really interesting one that comes to us from Prius Omega. It's a question that's been coming up for the last few days is, could you help us interpret the response to the reverse repo market? And I would throw one more out there, which is the IRR mechanical adjustment that got made today, 15 basis point adjustment coming out of this meeting, sort of made at the end with very little fanfare. Jay Powell talks about it as a mechanical adjustment to maintain rates. Any thoughts on either of those, Ed?
Yeah, I don't have any thoughts there. I know that I'm looking through my my notes here that Pedro da Costa, he was telling me, he's a reporter over at MNI, that the New York Fed gave this announcement the other day. The New York Fed undertakes certain small value open market transactions from time to time for the purpose of testing operational readiness to implement existing and potential policy directives from the Federal Open Market Committee, end quote. So that they released, Pedro tweeted this out 23 hours ago. I think that this is a lead up to what you're talking about. You know, it reminds me a little bit of watching paint dry stuff that the Fed was talking about. And also with regard to the repo market meltdown that we saw a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is that we're dealing with a system that's, we don't really understand the mechanics of the system entirely. Right. When the Fed is pumping money into the economy, pumping reserves into the economy, massive amounts of excess reserves, we don't really understand how the mechanics work. Because before 2008, there were no excess reserves. If there were, they were minuscule. And now, we're awash in reserves. So we're kind of learning as we go where the problems lie. And so that's how I take the statement.
Ed, did that highly technocratic statement that you just read add any clarity for you?
No, not at all. But it's just, it's basically what they're trying to say is, it's like watching paint dry. They're trying to say, no problem, we got this, right? But we know that isn't always what's happened in the past, bad things have happened.
I started chuckling immediately when you read it, just from the tone of the language says precisely that. Nothing to see here, folks. Move along.
Exactly.
Speaking of clarity, Ed, I know we have some big news today.
Yeah. The elephant in the room for the three of us while we're going through this is that no one knows that today is my last Real Vision Daily briefing, because I'm going to be moving on shortly from Real Vision. And so this is it. The three of us, we're on our last day. Coming out of talking about the Fed, it's really hard to to talk about that. But I have a few things to say, thank yous that I want to give to people who have made my life here amazing. You know, Real Vision's a great place. I love what we do. I love what I've done here and what you guys are going to continue to do. I first want to just give a shout out to some of the people that the viewers never see on camera or haven't seen on camera. First, the guy who's shooting this video right now, who's on this call. There are three of us. There are actually four of us on the call, three that you see. Peter Cooper, he's a guy who you don't see. I want to give a shout out to him. I want to also thank Nick Correa, who every other week is doing the exact same thing. And then the producers, Nico, Brian, Carmen, who helped keep the trains running on time in a very big way. And of course, our global head of operations and production, who owes me two drinks, by the way, I might add, in case you're watching this, Audrey. and my final thanks, of course, goes to the people who are on camera as well. Jack Hollywood Farley and Ash Bennington, a.k.a. Billy Ray Valentine. my former partner in crime, Roger Hurst, who we haven't seen for a long time. And of course, Rao Powell. And then finally, I would say thanks to all of you viewers and listeners for your patronage, your feedback. You've made me a better person. You've made RV a better platform. I'm going to miss you all.
Jack.
Yeah, I just have to say, Ash, transition from talking about one of the driest subjects in finance, like hardcore finance, reverse repo, IOER, to just smack in the face. We just smacked our viewers in the face with his bomb. So if you love deflation and you loved Ed Harrison, you had a bad day today. You thought your heart was broken at 4:40. Just wait. Yeah. No. I mean, I've known for about a week, and I was stunned and heartbroken because Ed, it'll be very hard to continue on doing this without you. I view you as a mentor, and I think a lot of people who are as viewers also look at you as a leading light. But I understand, you're moving on to a different place. Ash, what do you got to say?
I mean, Lewis Winthorpe III, opposite my Billy Ray Valentine, man, we've had an incredible run here, and it's been great. By the way, I'm looking at the comments right now on YouTube.
Going ballistic.
Yeah, just overwhelming outpouring, and it's going to be a great loss, Ed, to not have you on the show. I think people may know or they may not know that you were the prime mover behind coming up with this show. You created the idea. This was your brainchild during the darkest days of the COVID crisis, and you were able to come up with this incredible idea to get this on the air so that we could be responsive to daily market cycle events, respond to our subscribers and viewers' questions. And it's just been an incredible pleasure to do this with you. And we know that when you move on from here, you're going to do great things. And I'm going to be reading you wherever you land.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, Ash. And you guys got to keep it going. Keep the magic happening. As we talk about this, I think the since this is a macro show, this is a macro house RV. The question should be, so if I'm leaving, what the hell am I thinking about the economy, right? I think before we got on, we were saying, yeah, why don't you give us your deep dive or your semi deep dive? I don't know if you can call it deep into what I think's happening. So maybe we can talk about that for the last minutes of this RVDB. What do you guys?
That sounds great. Ed, let me throw out two user questions for you first, by the way. Two of our viewers have asked. Tom, did Jay Powell do this to you? And CG warns you had better not end up at the Fed.
That would be great. I love that. That is good. Yes. No Fed action for me. I'm sorry.
So please, we were going to talk a little bit more about your deep dive, your view of what's happening. Kind of, I would love to hear actually the big picture. Timing be damned here. We can run a little bit late today. I would love to hear your big picture view of how we got to where we are now, how you think about where we are now, and where we're going in the future.
Yeah, so I have five lines that I wrote out to sort of as crib notes for what I'm thinking about. And so you guys interrupt as I go through some of these. I think that, you know, line number one that I wrote is I'm a deflationist at heart, meaning that I think that demographics, debt, and deflation, the three D's, are the predominant secular pattern, and that this whole inflationist thing that we're going through as a result of the pandemic is temporary. So I do believe in the whole transitory narrative to a large degree. At the same time, let me say that I think inflation can be an issue, and it is an issue right now, even if it's transitory. The housing market in particular, asset price inflation is one of those places that we're seeing inflation. That's important. Car prices going up, that's important. It's also important in terms of food and energy, because that affects people very much. And so even if it is transitory, it can be important. The next thing I would say is, I want to be an optimist in the economy. I see some great changes that are happening. I like the Fed's flexibility. I like the flexibility that we've seen globally. You know, like when you look at Kurzarbeit in Germany, that model, helping them through hard times. I like what I've seen, and I like to be optimistic. However, at the same time, if you ask me, I'm probably closer to the Darius Dale, closer to David Rosenberg in terms of what I think are the risks going forward. I think that there is a great risk. It is greater than people think, of a relapse in growth in the second half of 2021. And it's not necessarily the case that even though the Democrats control both houses of Congress and the White House, that we're going to see the Democrats get a massive stimulus through. So either the consumer had better pick up the baton, or you're going to see some problems at some point, the latter half of this year, maybe the first half of 2022. The last thing is, I think that there are two black swans. I told you that. Let me stop there before if you guys have some questions, and then I'll tell you what my black swans are.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Chuck, go ahead.
Sure. I have something to say, which is that, you know, Ed, you said that you're not leaving to go work for the Fed, but some people in the audience are having a few doubts. Someone says, Ed, your name, it's actually Prius Omega, says, Ed, your name is only one letter off from Fed. Coincidence?
That is good. So here's my black swans for
Let me ask a question real quick, because I'm really curious. As you build up that deflation narrative, the transitory inflation narrative, eventually flipping into deflation, I'm curious, what are the key metrics that you're going to be watching to see if that thesis is playing out? What would confirm the thesis, and what would be some disconfirming data points, and over what time horizon as we roll forward?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that the nexus of the chain is about wages and leading to consumer spending, leading to greater industrial production, and then earnings growth and so forth, and eventually more employment, and then that's a virtuous cycle. So right now we're in the point where wages are going up and consumer spending is going up, and then supposedly it will lead to capital spending going up. Where we've seen a breakdown in past cycles is that people have said, actually, we're going to hold off. We're going to see how much this consumer spending and this wage growth goes on before we make the capital investments. And then we'll make the capital investments. And then, of course, growth waned and then capital investment. So what I'm looking for is that handoff from consumer spending to capital investment and the continuation of that virtuous cycle of, you know, wages going up, consumer spending going up on a durable basis without accumulation of debt, capital spending going up, and earnings for companies going up, and then more employment, and then wages going up, and the whole thing adding in that direction.
And I've just got a question. Sorry, what are you seeing in terms of CapEx? Are we seeing, so we're seeing consumer spending go up. Is the CapEx cycle, is that following?
My understanding is there is some incipient moves that make me slightly optimistic, but it's still too early to make a call. I mean, we're still at a very precarious moment in the reopening. So, I mean, when you think about it, we're not fully vaccinated. There's no herd immunity or anything like that. You know, I was watching the FOMC. Everyone was at home. You know, there were probably like three reporters who were at their studios. All the rest of the reporters who were talking to Jay Powell were in their houses. That's not normal. So we're not in a fully reopened economy. So anything that we think or we say is completely speculative.
Yeah. Very curious to hear about these black swans, Ed.
Yeah.
Yeah. One black swan. And by the way, you know, I don't think this would be a good RVDB without our touting some of our content on the platform. One thing that I've already touted is the Rumble in the Jungle, Peter Buchbar versus David Rosenberg. And in that video, I told them that I thought the black swan was housing, one of the two black swans. Housing could be a black swan. Why? Because there are incipient signs that housing is rolling over. You know, lumber prices have gone down. Mortgage applications have gone down. There are other things like that that could say that this house price inflation is coming down. And so when Eric Rosengren is saying that we might taper MBS more, that's all part of a nexus that could lead to house prices going into reverse in such a way that it creates some level of deleveraging. You know, if you're looking for wealth effects, housing is one of the greatest places that you can find wealth effects. And if that goes into reverse in any way, then that would be very negative for growth in the economy. So that's black swan number one. Mm. Unfortunately, black swan number two is the virus. You know, I'm sure there are going to be lots of people in the comments saying, oh, can you stop talking about coronavirus? But the reality is that we're not out of the woods yet. There are virus variants that can evade the vaccines that we have at present. And there are virus variants, as we've seen with the Delta variant, that are very contagious, much more contagious than the Alpha variant. Which started in Kent, England. So there are opportunities. There is a black swan risk that there's a variant that is both able to evade, you know, immunity, and also to be infectious at the same time. And if that were to happen, we could go back into a sort of pseudo lockdown situation, or the potential for economic uncertainty associated with that.
Yeah, such an important point from a black swan perspective. And I was joking with someone the other day when I said, the fact that we're sick of talking about the virus doesn't mean that the virus is done mutating. Again, an open question whether you'll get the nightmare strain that has the infectiousness and also the intensity, but something to watch out for, something that certainly we see these variants popping up around the world, very important to keep an eye on because of the potential economic impact if that were to happen.
Yeah, and you know, I think that it's the so-called Nepal variant that people are talking about. This is the one that makes me think about the black swan. This is a variant that is basically the Indian variant with the addition of the South African variant's spike protein ability to evade immunity from vaccines. So when you combine those two together, it creates, if in a population that's either unvaccinated or, you know, poorly vaccinated, the ability for it to circulate very quickly and then evade vaccines as well. So, you know, there are negative scenarios from a vaccine perspective. We're not out of the pandemic completely. Going to Miami was for me like my coming out of the pandemic. And, you know, I loved it, but hopefully that's the new normal. We'll see.
Yeah. You know, you said something that was really interesting, talking about the referencing to touting content. Boy, I did an interview today with a venture capitalist named Yasmin Rezavi from Spark Capital. And it's always a great feeling when you do what we do to interview someone who says in a more eloquent way the thing that you've been thinking. And she was talking about the long-term durable impact that the virus will have on the economy, not in terms of potential mutation risk, potential recurrence risk, but the changes in nature to the structure of work itself. You mentioned before watching the Jay Powell, Chairman Powell news conference and how many reporters were at home or elsewhere doing these interviews from remote locations. I think it's really interesting. I think that this is like a World War II level event for our culture, for our society, when we're having this conversation with our grandchildren. I think it's going to be one of those moments where there was a before and there was an after. The nature of work has changed. Supply chains has changed. The expectations that people have for their relationships with their employers have changed. I think this is the beginning of something that is durable and that will outlast, hopefully, a virus that is not going to be a major factor, hopefully, for much longer in the economy.
Yeah, let's hope that it won't be a factor in the economy, but it will be a factor in terms of changing our lifestyles. That's definitely my view as well. Yeah. Jack, any thoughts?
I don't know. I definitely think there are a lot of changes that I agree with, such as telemedicine. I don't think you're going to go to your doctor to get some sort of generic medication anymore. I think you'll just order it on online. I also think that a real change is that there are people now who are on unemployment who are making more money, receiving more money than they would at their old low wage jobs. And surprise, surprise, they would prefer to stay at home. I would prefer to stay at home too if I had that option. And I think that getting them to go back to work, and you know, companies like McDonald's or other places, you know, restaurants who have been used to, our labor cost is $8 per hour. That could no longer be a thing. Where I want to challenge a little bit is I think that, you know, Ash, you and I were in the Lower East Side last night getting some fried chicken, talking about what is going to be a post-ed RVDB. How would that even look like? So we're just having a little fun time. Like, people are going out. You know, if you go out on the weekend and you want to go to a hot restaurant, it's impossible to get a reservation. You know, there are vast swaths of land in the country where people are perhaps a slightly conservative, and you know, they had not been wearing masks since the summer, if at all. I think that even if this virus is, you know, even if the variant is really, really bad, I still think that psychologically, I feel like a lot of Americans and a lot of people have sort of moved on. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
I agree. I've moved on. You know, for me, it's over by and large. You know, but at the margin, I'm going to be changed. I went out to a restaurant too last night, and it was one of these places that has tables outside. I went to the outside tables. If let's say it's like November, what would I do? Chances are, you know, I probably am not going to eat inside. I probably would order out, and so that's a change in my behavior. Relative to before. And even if like 9 times out of 10, I do the exact same thing that I did before, 1 time out of 10 is enough to make a significant impact. And I think that, you know, companies that have low margins, when people start to change their behavior, you know, 1 person out of 10, it could be enough to have a sizable impact on that business.
Here, I've got a prediction.
Change happens at the margin. By the way, I've totally moved on as well. I'm out without a mask. I'm double vaccinated. This is as vaccinated as I'm going to get. Last night, I was much more worried about Jack killing me with the cholesterol levels at the restaurant we ate at. It was just like piles of butter and like maple syrup on everything and waffles and chicken. It was amazingly good.
Yeah, I've got a... So you're right that all the reporters, and I was very surprised to see that all the reporters were calling in from Zoom and talking to the Fed chair via Zoom. I think in the next FOMC meeting, there are going to be a lot more, if not every single one is going to be in person. I mean, you know, there are teachers who have been, you know, sort of taught remotely, and it's just been an absolute disaster. And, you know, some of them who, you know, are really focused and really want to get the kids, it's frustrating because every single kid is you can't see them. They're on the Zoom. And, you know, there are other people who are like sort of they're like, oh, I'll go to Hawaii. But I think that, you know, some people are going to have to come back home from Hawaii.
Yeah, look, the truth is probably going to land somewhere in between. There's some use cases that work for these technology-enabled distance learning. It's hard to understand how second or third graders are going to be able to learn meaningfully online. A lot of that is obviously the personal interaction and walking little Johnny back to his seat when he gets crazy, right? Like, I mean, that's what teaching at small grades is like. It's a very challenging job. But I think for others, look, the reality is you, Ed, and I, we're here doing what we do, powered by this revolution, able to do it from our homes and to do things that I think are innovative and interesting and make this show so fun and exciting to do.
Yeah. By the way, someone said, don't worry, Ed leaving is just transitory.
I got a pledge from the people that be that, you know, hey, you know, you'll take me back if it comes to that.
All right. Final question for our audience. I've copied and pasted all of these comments. If I make an NFT of these comments from this show, are you guys bidding?
Oh, man.
Well, I like that. That's good. Yeah, definitely. But I think Real Vision, you know, they're the ones who'd be selling the NFT. Am I right?
Is it? Yeah,
it's
sure.
It's very unclear. But the technology is, you know, from 2300, but the laws are very unclear, you know.
I think Raul's got to be the one who's at the top of the ticket selling it.
Gentlemen,
we don't want it to end. I mean, we could, you know, none of us want to end this. It's just, this is the last RVDB.
Well, so I have two more. I'm going to tout my last two appearances. Pavlina Cherneva, who's going to tell us about the economy, the jobs market from an NMT's perspective, and then my well-touted David Rosenberg, Peter Buchbar interview.
And then today, Ed, your interview with Warren Mosler.
And today's interview with Warren Mosler, which I might say, I think is the best MMT interview that I've ever done because... you know, we got to see behind the curtain in terms of basically there's a coercion there with the government. And Warren Mosler, he's not necessarily down with that coercion, but that's just the reality. I think that was an interesting observation from him.
Yeah, very interesting in shifting the narrative there a little bit on what MMT is, what it means, what the politics around it are. Maybe you could talk to that a little bit, Ed, because it's such an important point.
Yeah, so, I mean, here's my take. And I may have said this actually on Twitter. I'm going to look and see how I put it on Twitter because that might be a good jumping off point for thinking about it. What I said is that I got three takeaways. The sense I got was, no, Joe Biden is not doing MMT, okay? Joe Biden is a guy, from what Warren Mosler was saying, Joe Biden is a guy who wants to raise taxes on the rich. That's not MMT. MMT is telling you that when the private sector wants to net save, accommodate it. Don't raise taxes. So Joe Biden is definitely, definitely, definitely not doing MMT.
Yeah.
Can I say that any more clearly? He's not doing MMT. That's number one.
I think
number
in sorry, go ahead.
Number two is that you don't do MMT. When people say, is this guy doing MMT or is that gal doing MMT? No, BS. You don't do MMT. MMT is a framework. I have a mutual friend with Ash, this guy, John Carney. Ash was even telling me that he went out at some point with Warren Moser and John Carney together. Now, John Carney's a guy who is the economics head of Breitbart, you know, a conservative magazine. Hello, he's an MMTer. You don't have to believe in big government to be an MMTer. So you're not. It's not about doing MMT. It's about understanding the MMT framework and believing that that's a way in which the current fiat currency system works. Yeah. I have two other things, but Jack, you wanted to get in there.
Oh,
and by the way, I would just say nobody's ever accused John Carney of being a socialist.
Exactly.
Yeah, no. Yeah, yeah. I don't know a lot of... anyway, I was going to say, Ed, that in Stephanie Kelton's book, The Deficit Myth, I think the first myth that she wants to dispel is that the government is not a household. If you are a monetary sovereign, you can spend more than you take in because you can create currency out of thin air. I would say that perhaps what you're saying is that Joe Biden, he acts as, in a framework as if the government is sort of like a household, in that you, you do have to pay the reaper, even though MMT says you don't.
And the way that that Warren Moser puts it is that's a political constraint. You know, the reality is no one's ever going to, I mean, the slippery slope of, hey, wait a minute, I can just spend and spend, you know, that's a road to inflation. And so for political reasons, people stop that. They put a constraint on that. But that constraint is artificial. It's political. And that was my third point that I put down. Here, I said the political constraints to thinking about policy through an MMT lens are underestimated. That was my last takeaway from what he said. Ultimately, I just think that there's a lot of confusion still over what MMT is, that it's a framework and it's not a set of policies. When people talk about MMT, usually they're talking about, you know, big government or lots of spending, you know, lots of deficits, but you can do all those things and not understand MMT or not have an MMT framework. And you can also do the opposite, as John Carney would probably do, and not do those things and still look at it from an MMT perspective. So that was those were my takeaways from the interview.
Ash, I don't know if you see this, but there's a question I think would be a perfect way to end on a high note, which TomTom asks, Ed, a question for you. What were your most memorable moments with Ash and Jack?
Yeah, that's a good question. My most memorable moments, my people don't want to hear this, but my most memorable moments were asking Ash and about soccer and making him a Tottenham Hotspur fan. right before this, when Ash and I were talking, like at 1 o'clock, we were talking about we got to get a soccer reference in there because I tweeted this thing about Cristiano Ronaldo and you know, he was at a news conference and they tried to give him some Coke and he batted it away and said, no, I want water. And immediately Coke's share price went down like, you know, $1.5 billion. So I thought that was hilarious.
Jack, any favorite memories you'd like to contribute?
Oh, man. I think, you know, when you do something every day, it's just like every day is a memory. But I just think the experience of building the Daily Briefing from nothing into a show, you know, Ash, I remember a call with you when you said, hey, man, we've got to do this opening segment. And I'm like, what is this opening segment? And it was basically we were reading, you know, data about the coronavirus, which was very grim. And that sort of morphed into what was then called the Real Vision Daily Briefing intro. So then I remember, you know, our morning calls where, you know, we were like me, Ash and Ed, and we were like, what's on your radar? And you, Ed, you had like 11 stories. You want to talk about this? You want to talk about that? You want to talk about this? And yeah, now here we are. So it's just been a great journey. What about you, Ash?
I think my favorite memory with Ed is every day around 3 o'clock before I'm about to go on air with Ed, there's that tension I get in the pit of my stomach that says, you better study up because you're going on air with Ed Harrison and you need to be able to hit the ball back over the net.
You know, the thing that I'm missing, I wish I could have it, is that great t-shirt that I could, zip down and open up, that, you know, that one of our viewers sent me. Because to me, that's representative of what Real Vision is the rapport that we have with one another and that we've developed with our viewers, with our listeners. And I just hope that, I know actually, what am I saying? That it will continue even without me being on RVDB. And I look forward to watching and listening and just wish you guys all the best.
Well, we want to see you in the YouTube comments.
Yes, you will see me in the YouTube comments. Yes.
Okay, great.
And any final thoughts before we go?
None. Just I'm going to go up and grab some alcohol.
You know, this is truly the end of an era, not just for us here at Real Vision, but I think it's important to point out for the viewers who have been with us every step of the way, overwhelming comments today. And we just thank you so much for watching us. Obviously, it's the reason we do what we do. So thank you very much for joining us on this journey. And thank you, Ed Harrison.
Thank you, guys. And kisses to everyone. Love you guys.
Thanks for watching, everyone.